It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Democrats are now firmly in control of the state's highest court for the foreseeable future after Tuesday's election results. Democratic Superior Court judges David Wecht and Christine Donahue, both of Allegheny County, joined with Philadelphia Common Pleas Judge Kevin Dougherty to lead the seven-person field for the three open seats on the state Supreme Court. Judge Wecht called it a new day for the high court. He joins us now in studio. David Wecht, congratulations on your victory. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here.
You can join the conversation with a comment or question by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Again, the number 412-246-2002. Please bear in mind that Judge Wecht is not allowed to talk about pending cases or cases that could come before the court. That having been said, David Wecht, this has to mean a lot to you and your family, your father, Cyril Wecht. Talk about winning this seat.
Well, it was a wonderful night. We had a lot of fun at our election party, and it's an opportunity that I look forward to rendering quality decision-making in service of the law, in service of the people of our Commonwealth.
What kind of an opportunity does this create for the Supreme Court to move into its next chapter, as a lot of people have described it?
It is a time of great change in our Supreme Court. During the campaign, I pointed out a number of times that the flip side of crisis is always opportunity, and the opportunity presented itself to turn a new leaf and elect jurists who would do principled service and orient themselves to the task at hand, which is to decide cases expeditiously, decide them on a principled basis, decide them with quality, and I hope focus more on the law and less on distractions. So the opportunity presents itself now with an ongoing process of evolution and change in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court that exists on New Year's Day in 2020 will be six-sevenths different from what it was around 2013 or so. So in about seven-year span, you have essentially the entire court except for one justice changing, which is, you know, remarkable amount of change, particularly in judicial terms. As most of your listeners know, appellate courts don't turn over so dramatically in such a period of time, such short a period of time. So really, I suppose somebody somewhere, perhaps in this studio 50 years hence, will look back and remark upon the shift in the Pennsylvania court. Hopefully it'll be for good and not for ill. And I certainly will do my best to ensure that it's a positive evolution.
Much has been made of the influence of money on this campaign. The election was overshadowed in many ways by the attack ads paid for by outside groups at a reported cost of between, if you add the primary and the general election advertising costs together, we're coming to a figure of nearly $16 million, which set a national record for spending on a court race. It came from both Republican and Democratic supporters. What is your take on the issue of how money influenced this and other elections?
Well, the United States Supreme Court in the Citizens United case said that money is speech. I don't happen to agree with that. I think money is money. Unfortunately, the United States Supreme Court thinks otherwise and has said that money is speech. So the interpretation of the United States Constitution's First Amendment is the province of the Supreme Court of the United States at its apogee. So I don't have the, I certainly don't have the jurisdiction, neither I nor any other Pennsylvania judge, to supplant the jurisprudence of the United States Supreme Court on the United States Constitution. So unless and until the United States Supreme Court reverses itself in Citizens United, or the United States Constitution is amended to provide otherwise, we will all live in a world where, unfortunately, money is speech. So we can beat our breasts or beat our head against the wall all we want. But in the meantime, this is the constitutional regime under which we operate. That said, I find deplorable the negative advertising that goes on from any direction. I myself have never participated in it, don't condone it, and I think it's offensive. In fact, I don't even watch advertising. I don't watch TV in real time. I try to catch shows on demand with my wife at night when time permits, like Homeland or The Nick, etc. But the only reason I've seen my own ads is they get emailed to me for my approval. It is sad that we have an industry of negative advertising. But again, we can complain about it all we want, but it's like complaining about weather. You know, weather's going to happen. And it's cheap talk to rail against it, given that that's what the law provides.
It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking with Judge David Wecht, who has been elected to a seat on the state Supreme Court. If you have a comment or question, if you wish to join the conversation, 412-246-2002, the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM, on Twitter at ESSPGH. And you have participated in candidates' forums, including one in Homewood, which I had the opportunity to moderate late last month. And there were a number of questions that came up. It was a very informative event, as it turned out, held at the Homewood, the Carnegie or Homewood branch of the Carnegie Public Library, and an auditorium. There was probably about between 150 and 200 people, all of whom had great questions, as well as a list of prepared questions that I asked. And I thought it would be interesting to get into some of the issues that were brought up, because it certainly relates to your job going forward. One of the things that came up during the forum in Pittsburgh, City Council created a law, as we all know, we've discussed it on this program, a law mandating sick days for all workers. Is there any reason that this law could be subject to challenge at the state Supreme Court level? And if so, why?
That's exactly the type of question I can't answer.
Okay.
That's exactly the type of... That's emblematic of a type of case that could come before the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. I would hate to have any of your listeners sitting somewhere a year from now saying, gosh, Justice Wecht talked about this very case on Paul's show, and here he is writing an opinion one way or another on it. So I'm going to respectfully decline to comment, not because I want to be coy or duck it, but because the Code of Judicial Conduct prohibits me.
Sure, and the rules here seem to be clear, and yet, you know, there are things that come up that even last month that I didn't expect to hear folks like yourself talking about, but you were able to. So we'll move on to other things.
Well, that one I definitely didn't talk about.
Right,
But if you want to, you know, as I told you when we talked about scheduling this, there's nothing that you or any of the listeners could say or ask me that would offend me, because I spent many years in the family division. So I'm incapable of being shocked, but I will. So feel free to throw any question at me you like, and I will feel free to tell you when I'm not able to answer it.
That's more than fair. So we'll move on to something else here. Let's talk about the prison system. What concerns do you have about our current prison system, and what positive changes do you believe judges can make?
I have enormous concerns about our prison system. Every American and every Pennsylvanian should. We are warehousing at enormous expense large numbers of people. There are some people who need to be put behind very, very high, very, very thick walls for very, very long times. And then there are people who are nonviolent offenders, many with serious mental health problems and serious addiction issues, who can be handled and treated much less expensively and less dangerously, and I'll get to that in a minute, in the community through community corrections and tight probation and parole supervision. People don't understand that it costs somewhere in the ballpark of between $35,000 and $43,000 per year per inmate in the state correctional system. So as I've said before, this is not a question of mercy. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that each and every one of us and each and every one of the listeners is the most cold-hearted, hard-line person, throw-away-the-key mentality as possible. Let's concede that for the sake of argument. There is probably no one who wants to spend as much of his or her tax dollars on this warehousing function, given that we're going to have to do so with respect to the most violent offenders and those from whom society has a right to exact retribution or impose the most severe punishment. It is, and people need to focus on this, tremendously expensive to incarcerate. And I fear that our elected leaders don't confront that reality. So when people wonder why their taxes are so high and why they seem to get so little for their taxes, the enormous and growing corrections budget is a part of it. Now, it's easy for me to talk about this. The reality is that it falls to the executive and legislative branches principally to do something about it. The legislators make the laws. The judges do not make the laws, and the executive runs the prisons. The judges don't run the prisons. However, in recent years, the courts, and not just in Pennsylvania, but around the entire country, have been developing and rolling out what we call problem-solving courts. And these include courts that focus on the special problems that our veterans confront, including veterans confronted with post-traumatic stress. These are problem-solving courts that recognize the unique problems that arise in addiction, both drugs and alcohol. These are courts that deal with other specialized problems and manifest the judicial recognition that even in the absence of meaningful legislative reform, the courts can take the initiative to try to divert some nonviolent offenders in ways that will ensure public safety and at the same time reduce recidivism, because recidivism is enhanced through the mindless application of incarceration to the nonviolent when a less restrictive means is available that is consistent with public safety. So there are many offenders who can be handled that way. Let me jump from the general to the particular. Recently, to give people a context, recently I had the privilege of joining with Judge Kevin Sazanowski, an Allegheny County judge, and a number of other judges and citizens at a ceremony that marked the 10th anniversary of the DUI court. There are many people, as we all know, that have a very, very significant alcohol addiction program. And the DUI court pioneered in the Allegheny County Court of Common Pleas recognizes that and imposes a very, very strict zero tolerance mechanism while at the same time ensuring counseling and treatment, and does a much, much better job of keeping our roads safe, keeping our people safe, and ensuring that people take the right path to recovery and avoid clogging our prisons unnecessarily by setting up a system that monitors compliance and ensures improvement. So that's been a real track record of success.
So certainly what you're emphasizing here is you're saying that when possible, you would like to emphasize rehabilitation as opposed to incarceration.
Well, that's generally true. That's generally true. And of course, it falls to individual trial judges and individual cases, essentially, to determine rehabilitation potential. And we all know that there are some criminals who sadly cannot be rehabilitated, but there are others, as I've said, principally people with significant addiction issues who are susceptible to rehabilitation. And courts need to apply a nuanced approach rather than a bludgeon in dealing with that.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with soon-to-be Supreme Court Judge David Wecht. We have Janice from Greensburg on the line. Janice, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Judge Wecht.
Thank you very much for taking my call, and congratulations on your win.
Thank you.
I'm troubled by what appears to be a lack of integrity on the judicial branch, and I was wondering if you've given any thought to that.
I certainly have. Is it Janice or Janet?
Janice.
Janice, thank you for the question. I have. Way back in early February, I rolled out a 5-point plan. Number one, no more gifts to judges. Number two, no more nepotism in the courts. Three, put a camera in the courtroom so we can see and hear what's done and said in our name and on our nickel. Four, mandatory judicial ethics training for all judicial candidates. And five, require that judges state on the record why they grant or deny a motion to recuse. We need a court that is transparent. Justice Brandeis wrote about 100 years ago that sunlight is the best disinfectant. I firmly believe that. We need to get away from a culture of closure in favor of a culture of openness in our courts. And I'd like to see more public education about the courts. And I'd like to see the courts embrace the reforms of which I've spoken and which I've proposed now for several months.
Janice, thank you for that phone call. Let's go to Jerry in Sharpsburg. Jerry, you're on with Judge Wecht.
Thank you for taking my call, and congratulations, Judge.
Thank you, Jerry.
My question is, much has been made that three Democrats have risen to the court. If justice is blind and is to be based, decisions should be based on the law, what difference would it make if they're Republicans or Democrats?
Well, you know, I think our Constitution and laws contemplate a party system. So you or I could prefer a different system if we like, but this is the system we have. We have partisan elections under our laws in Pennsylvania. Once a justice takes the robes and is sworn in, she or he does not apply a Republican or a Democratic outlook or jurisprudence, but rather applies the Constitution and laws and hopefully reaches a principled decision.
Jerry, thank you for bringing that up. You know, one of the things that I know people wonder about are that our Supreme Court justices in Pennsylvania are elected rather than appointed. From your perspective, what is the effect of the electoral process on Supreme Court justices?
The effect in the near term is sheer and utter exhaustion. I take it that your question is the relative merits and demerits of the two systems.
Right. Which works better? Which serves the people and the citizens of the Commonwealth the best?
Both are very problematic. I think the question isn't which serves the people the best. The question ought to be which is less bad. So there is no.
Why do you couch it that way?
There's no perfect system. So you know the infirmities of both are apparent. As all the listeners recognize, as you've indicated, the fundraising burden in a Supreme Court race is substantial, and presents the obvious challenges about impartiality and the appearance of partiality. One of the problems, obviously, with an appointive system is who does the appointing. So there's an element of patronization or condescension in advocating for an appointive system in suggesting that the people are not smart enough to appoint to select their own judges, and that power has to be taken away from the people and put in somebody else's hands. So our Constitution, and this is a Constitution, not a mere statute. Our Constitution in Pennsylvania provides for electing judges, and the burden is on those who want to amend the Constitution. It always is, of course, and it's a heavy burden. Here, the burden is particularly heavy because it would take a power away from the people. It would remove the franchise and put it in someone else's hands. So the question is, who gets that power?
Right, and it's interesting because at the U.S. Supreme Court level, the president appoints, the Congress approves, or the Senate approves. At the state level here in Pennsylvania, it's up to the voters. So we see different approaches at different levels, and I suppose maybe what it comes down to is which one, as you put it, is less bad, because no system is perfect.
That's unquestionably the case, and you know that either system is capable of creating a rogue, or you know, countenancing a rogue. And there are federal judicial rogues, there are state judicial rogues all across this country. The vast majority of judges, both state and federal, are highly qualified, dedicated individuals. And as in every other profession, unfortunately, there are going to be outliers who are not optimal. And both systems, appointive and federal, are capable of letting somebody by, sadly, that does not measure up. And the fact that somebody is nominated by the president and confirmed by the U.S. Senate, unfortunately, does not immunize them from human frailty. That said, there is no question in my mind that the people of Pennsylvania ought to have a dialogue, a conversation about this. And it's a conversation that needs to be had. And the process of constitutional convention is extremely cumbersome and very rare. It is more likely that should such a change be coming, it's going to come through the other mechanism, which is passage in two consecutive sessions of the General Assembly, and then passage by popular referendum. And so, you know, that is a conversation that ought to be had. I think, again, that conversation, if and when it happens, is going to highlight virtues and problems in both systems, and then we ought to have at it and see what the people think.
412-246-2002 is the number to call if you would like to join our conversation with Judge David Wecht, who's just been elected to the state Supreme Court. Let's go to Michael from Shaler. Michael, you're on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I want to go back just briefly to the rehabilitation as opposed to incarceration discussion. There was a case, and I can't remember the specifics, so I apologize, but it was a year or so ago that got some national news about a young man under 18, I believe, or under 21 for sure, who was driving driving drunk and ended up hitting some people off the side of the road. And he was from a well-to-do family, and his punishment, as it were, was a rehabilitation facility in California that included horseback riding and a lot of other things that we view as things that we would like to do in or out of rehabilitation. So I'm just wondering if there's any way to determine, you know, based on how bad a crime is, if rehabilitation is really the just kind of decision that should be made based on it. And I'll take my response off the air.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Michael. Michael highlights the most important point that it's up to the individual judge in the individual case to fashion justice, whatever fashion that consists of. And this is why the appellate courts rely so heavily on the discretion of the trial judges. The sentencing decision is confided in the sound discretion of the trial judge. And in a case of the type that Michael mentioned, or in any manner of other case, the judge has before her or him a whole host of data, including the violence done to individuals or to a community, the wantonness or lack of wantonness involved in the crime, the harm to the public, the potential for future harm, the recidivism risk, and of course, prior record. So, and as Michael probably knows, and as most of your listeners probably know, there is always a pre-sentence report that's done, and a variety of pieces of data which go into the input and which form the calculus for the trial judge to consider. So certainly the types of facts that Michael was talking about would all be taken into account. And I certainly don't think that horseback riding is a necessary part of any sentence, although I do think horseback riding is very enjoyable. One of these days I'm going to get back on a horse.
One of the things I wanted to bring up, I don't know to what extent you can discuss this, but it came up at the candidates forum last month in Homewood. Many of the issues that came up, in fact, connect directly to the national movement of Black Lives Matter. And both nationally and in Pittsburgh, there have been high-profile cases of people of color dying at the hands of law enforcement. What do you think the Supreme Court can do to make sure that Black Lives Matter?
The courts have an obligation to apply equal justice for all, and as everybody knows, that requires absolute colorblindness. The courts have a duty to apply principled justice and to scrutinize the facts and apply the law to the facts equally. We have a constitution, and the constitution guarantees due process of law and equal treatment of the law. Everybody recognizes that we have a history in our country that has not always lived the values that our Constitution espouses, and there are ongoing effects of past discrimination, and there remains current discrimination in many spheres of life. So it is sometimes the duty of the courts to examine a set of facts, and there are times when a case could present a constitutional violation. And one of the beauties of our system, going back now well over 200 years, is that it is the duty of the courts to say what the law is, meaning that between the statutes passed by the legislature are gaps. This is why we have lawsuits. This is why we have cases. Not every statute can foresee in detail every single case that arises. And the courts have an obligation to apply precedents and interpret statutes. And there are times when racial situations, since your case related to race, could arise. And the courts, going back to many cases in our history, have been called upon to enforce our highest ideals. I know I'm speaking in general terms.
No, but that's what you have to
do.
But
your question, your question is phrased in terms that I can't really address otherwise.
That's why we dance along the boundaries. Certainly, it's a blessing, but also a curse that you're a popular man, and we have other people waiting to ask you questions. I know you have a tight schedule. Can you stay with us for a few more minutes after a break?
Yes, I can. I can stay with you till about 12:45, 12:50.
I think we can make that work. So let's take a break, and we'll continue our conversation with Judge David Wecht, who's just been elected to the State Supreme Court. And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. We'll get to your calls after a break. This is Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Judge David Wecht, who has been elected to the State Supreme Court, filling one of three open seats, along with Christine Donahue and Common Pleas Judge Kevin Dougherty, all three Democrats elected to fill the three open seats from that seven-person field. The results coming in a couple of days ago on Election Day, so the candidate has... Or now the judge-elect has joined us in studio to talk about issues and take your questions. If you have a comment or question for Judge David Wecht, 412-246-2002. Let's go to Joe from Mount Washington. Joe, welcome. You're on with David Wecht.
Yes. My question relates to Citizens United.
The judge summarized it basically as money equals speech, but my understanding of Citizens United is that it relates to independent expenditures. And I guess my question is, under the judge's interpretation of the First Amendment, how is it that the Federal Elections Commission can control elections expenditures that are independent from the campaigns and not impose restrictions on free speech? And I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks. Well, the answer is it can't. So the commission and its state correlates cannot control the independent expenditures, and that's the challenge that with which Citizens United confronts us all. So, you know, that's why I said that complaining about this is like complaining about weather. It's going to happen, and there's no principled way. If we grant that money is speech, then how do we regulate it? You know, we all know it is generally not lawful to have prior restrictions on speech, right? So if money is speech, you can't really have prior restrictions on money. Given that, these independent expenditures are going to continue to metastasize unless and until, again, as I said, either the Supreme Court of the United States reverses itself or a constitutional amendment is passed, that is, to our United States Constitution.
Joe, thank you for that question. Let's go to Mark in Squirrel Hill. Hi, Mark. You're on with Judge Wecht.
Thank you. And congratulations, Judge Wecht.
Thank you.
My question is, gerrymandering has been getting worse and worse and is becoming the norm in Pennsylvania as in other states. Do you see in the next redistricting where there will be efforts made to compact some of the districts, such as the one that extends from Johnstown all the way into Allegheny County?
The particular maps that will evolve in the future are, number one, beyond my ken, and number two, not something about which I could opine, but I can tell you that that extreme gerrymandering is an abomination and antithetical to the concept of one person, one vote. The Constitution contemplates that legislative districts are to be contiguous and compact and generally not to fracture municipalities or neighborhoods, and the deliberate disenfranchisement of people, the deliberate disenfranchisement of one party or the other for political reasons is deeply problematic. It is not the role of the court to draw legislative districts in a partisan fashion. It is the role of the court to appoint the fifth member, the tiebreaker member, to the commission that will be set up after the 2020 census, and it then will be the job of that five-member commission to draw the state legislative maps, and then the Supreme Court, of course, will rule on any challenges to those maps. And it is my hope, and I'm sure the hope of the other justices, to see districts that comport with our Constitution and that do not violate the principle of one person, one vote. Our system is not supposed to disenfranchise people, nor is it supposed to be set up to try to enshrine permanently a temporal majority.
Let's go to Christy in Beachview. Christy, you're on the air with Judge Wecht. Hi.
Hi. So happy with the way the election went. So, but that's an aside. My question is kind of off topic. I wonder about what it's like to be a judge and now a Supreme Court judge, and how that affects your personal life when everything is recorded. You can be snapped at the grocery store or filmed at a stoplight, or let's say you make a misjudgment or you feel a flash of anger in public. How carefully do you have to watch your P's and Q's, and how does it affect your personal and family life?
Very interesting question, Christy.
It is an excellent question. Thank you, Christy. And you're very perceptive to identify that as a concern. The Code of Judicial Conduct contemplates and provides that judges must comport themselves appropriately, not only in the courtroom and in their judicial work, but in their extrajudicial, which is to say non-judicial lives as well. So judges don't have the luxury, as others do, of quote, acting out, unquote. And all the things you talked about, all the scenarios that you talked about are times when each judge has to assume that she or he might be watched, and the people are entitled to judges that act with appropriate decorum. So in that sense, judges are really never off the clock, except I suppose within the four walls of their home. Well, I guess unless and until the NSA is in there, but
Big Brother is watching.
Yeah, so you're absolutely correct, Christy. And I, as I said, very perceptive to note that judges are subject to public scrutiny really at all times, and the sorts of behavior that might not necessarily reflect so poorly on folks. Might reflect poorly on judges. You will not, for example, hear any raucous criticism of referees at my kids, from me, that is, at my kids' sporting events.
We are just about out of time, but one last thing I wanted to bring up is that over the past year, we've seen multiple instances of local officials resisting the U.S. Supreme Court's rulings on same-sex marriage. What do you believe should be the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's role in interpreting and enforcing the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions on same-sex marriage?
So the United States Supreme Court's, and I want to emphasize this again, the United States Supreme Court's interpretations of the United States Constitution are paramount. The courts of the states do not get to abrogate or second guess interpretations of the United States Supreme Court on the U.S. Constitution, unlike our own Constitution. So the Obergefell decision to which you refer is the law of the land. The, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. said about 100 years ago or more that the reason that the law is a profession and the reason that people will pay lawyers is to predict what the outcome in court will be, to predict what the courts will say, because in certain cases, the entire power of the state will be brought to bear to enforce the decisions of the courts. That's one of the beauties of our system, that the courts have neither the power of the purse nor the power of the sword, but the entire power of the state is brought to bear. So in the case you mentioned, the Obergefell decision is the decision of it's the law of our land, and the courts in Pennsylvania or Missouri or Idaho or California or Kentucky don't get to second guess it.
Judge David Wecht joining us on Essential Pittsburgh. He has just been elected to the state Supreme Court as a judge, filling one of the three open seats, along with two other Democrats, Christine Donahue and Kevin Dougherty. Judge Weck, congratulations. It's a pleasure having you here.
Likewise.
An enlightening conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Paul.
Coming up, a preview of Audubon Day in Pittsburgh. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.